Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. It is the 6th of July, 2013, and it's time for another edition of the Geneva Business Insider with our friend, the Geneva Business Insider himself, David L. Smith of GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. This is like some twisted version of a tongue twister. Geneva Business Insider, Geneva Business Insider, Geneva Business Insider. David Smith, thank you for joining us, as always, from the sunny climes of Geneva, Switzerland.
It's a pleasure to be back once again.
Excellent. Well, there's so much going on in the world that it's difficult to know where to begin, but I understand you were recently talking to someone who is fresh in from Egypt, so I think we should perhaps start there with, as I'm sure many of the listeners are aware, the Egyptian military performing a coup against Morsi in the Muslim Brotherhood, and things once again in complete turmoil. Why don't you tell us what your friend was telling you about what's happening in Egypt?
Yeah, well, my friend works in the oil industry, and he works on platforms, and he was flown by the companies working with to Cairo, and then the idea was he was going to take an internal flight from Cairo to Alexandria, and hence a helicopter onto his platform. Anyway, he arrived in Cairo and found himself holed up in a hotel exactly a few hours before the final deadline was announced. He sent me a rather touching message saying there are no internal flights. Perhaps with the help of the military, I can get to Alexandria by tank. So I pointed out it's a pity the British military no longer had Harrier aircraft, because that would have been much more comfortable and convenient. So obviously the situation in Egypt is, to my mind, totally predictable. All we have to do is to look to their almost next door neighbor, Algeria, and we're seeing exactly the same thing. And that is that there were meant to be free elections some, I think, 30 years ago now in Algeria. When the Islamist extremist movements got in, the army took over and seized power. And then that led to a 10-year civil war. My wife originally is from Algeria, so I know the situation there very well. And I've seen the horror it can impose on normal families, which is exactly what's happening in Egypt at the moment. And there I think I'm qualified to talk, because my brother-in-law, as well as being Swiss, is also originally Egyptian. But these people have no hesitation about throwing the general public in prison, beatings, you can see them filmed on the street. And all of these things basically are, to my mind, an indirect consequence of American foreign policy. Now, we're talking about pumping a couple of billion of aid into Egypt every year for military purposes, but how much of that ends up in offshore bank accounts and in juicy contracts for major American corporations, one can only be left to guess. So I think we have a demonstration of failure of the American strategy here, and we don't really need to dig very far to realize who the Muslim Brotherhood are. I mean, this was an organization that was set up in basically by the Americans in the 50s to destabilize the government in Egypt at that time. And it's just been a low-intensity Islamic organization. And then there are people who come along and say, well, of course, they got the biggest number of votes at the last election. Well, yes, that is true, but they were the only semi-organized group in the country. And the only alternative that was offered was our dear charming friend, Mr. El-Baradei, who is nothing more than a lackey for the interests of the CFR and the American State Department. And I think anyone who's hailed by Mrs. Clinton at the time, and no doubt by Mr. Kerry now, as being the ideal solution, the people of the country should be extremely wary as to what the underlying motives are. So I just see Egypt as a sad repetition of what happened in Algeria. And I give you two anecdotes, one from my own family, where my wife's sister was arrested and held in Algeria for 3 days without any trace of her whatsoever. She was just taken off a plane. And as far as we could establish after the events, when she was finally released, after many members of the family had also been arrested, was that she probably sat next to somebody with doubtful reputation in a cafe that was frequented by Algerians in Geneva. And the other story I could tell is one of the top generals of the Algerian army, who actually had to fight against these Muslim extremists until they were finally driven out of the country, And having a beer with him, and he was practically in tears in the evening, saying, you know, all of those who came in my year of recruitment, only about 20% of us actually survived these very difficult times, because they were killed in attacks in the middle of the night, or assassinated, or whatever. So this is what I think Egypt is going towards. And when you look now at Algeria, it's got oil and gas reserves of great significance. So all the colonial powers would love to recolonialize and control it. And of course, we look at Egypt, where it's immensely strategic importance because of its next door neighbor being Israel, who, needless to say, want to make sure that their next door neighbor doesn't attack them. And of course, there is a little thing called the Suez Canal, through which vast amounts of oil transit on a daily basis. And I think there's the statistic, somewhere around 10 or 12% of world trade goes through the Suez Canal in terms of value. So there we are, a complete mess. The misery for the people is totally predictable, and the real power interests are very obviously barely hiding behind the scenes.
Unfortunately, you're exactly correct in that assessment, and you're exactly right that Egypt is just too important for the U.S. and Israel to merely leave it alone to go as it will. So that's I think it's impossible to understand the history of Egypt or what's happening currently without understanding the constant outside interference in Egyptian politics that have been there for at least half a century, as you point out. And for people who are more interested in that history of the Muslim Brotherhood and its deep connections with the CIA, I would suggest they go back to Corbett Report Radio, episode 264, Who Are the Muslim Brotherhood, where I talked about that in some degree of detail, and there's a lot to go into with that history. But is there anything that we can say in terms of the actual people involved, the Egyptian people? They seem to be caught between a rock and a hard place in all of this, because it really seems that the only two options that are allowed to them on this table are the military or the Muslim Brotherhood. Is there any way between that rock and hard place for the Egyptian people themselves?
Well, I think the West is going to pretend that there is. They're going to pretend that they're there to bring freedom and democracy. But I would say that the future holds probably something extremely similar to Algeria. And although that is pretty grim, it is one step better than what the Allies have managed to bring to the other next-door neighbor, which is Libya. And they potentially can also bring to Syria very shortly. You know, this whole kind of instability... The most important thing is to create stability, and that is not always done in a very nice way. And with Algeria, for example, the military basically runs the country, but there's a facade of democracy in front of it. There are elections, there is a president, he has been basically a good man, and not exactly an establishment figure, although he's not outside of those circles. He's not one of the CFR favorites, so that's for sure. But I think the army will take control. And if you look at these countries, you know, senior army officers have got very, very large economic interests in what goes on in the country. You know, they own the major hotels or business centers or transport companies or refrigeration companies and construction companies. And those interests are actually very good, because it creates employment, and it means that the military want the country to function correctly. And the people who get in the way of that are treated a bit like recruits in the army who misbehave. It's not necessarily ideal, but it's a lot better than the Muslim Brotherhood solution, which was the one in Algeria, where you could get your throat cut in the street because you happen to be a woman studying at a university. That, in fact, happened to my family. Some of them came to study in Switzerland, simply because the risks to their lives, directly to their lives, were such that it was no longer safe to go to university. It wasn't safe to go out after sunset. The main streets, which would be like, Fifth Avenue or something like that, after 8 o'clock at night, there was no one on them, apart from police patrols going up and down, and that was like that for years. So that is, unfortunately, what the consequences of external intervention to bring freedom and democracy to these countries who have never heard of what that really means and were 100 times happier without it in the first place.
Exactly right. Sadly right. Well, if the long-term strategy is to pretend to bring the order out of the chaos that they themselves have created, I think, unfortunately, it's already being successful with people dying and some of the clashes between pro-Morsi supporters and anti-Morsi protesters. It's a very, very difficult situation, and one that we'll have to keep following as it continues to develop. But on another note, for just a remarkable international geopolitical incident, the president of Bolivia was denied access to French and Portuguese airspace on the suspicion that Edward Snowden was on his plane, and he was forced to the ground in Austria, where his plane was searched and discovered not to be carrying Edward Snowden. A pretty remarkable incident, and I would love to get your take on what happened here and what this actually means about the international state of asylum seeking in general.
Well, I think this is an extraordinary demonstration of arrogance on the one hand, violation of international law on the other, and lack of contemplation of what the indirect consequences of their acts are going to be. I happened to be in Austria exactly at the same time, although fortunately I was sitting beside a lake in the sunshine while these events were unfolding in Vienna. But it's very disturbing to the Austrian people. And, for an aircraft to be forced onto the ground, one could have said if he'd refused to do that, would it have been shot down? And on what possible basis could it be done? And then we look at the outrage which is provoked by incidents where American aircraft have ended up being forced landed in places like China, or perhaps more recently we could mention maybe Afghanistan, where a helicopter ended up in somebody's backyard, and of course the Americans wanted it back. But yeah, they're quite happy to go along and say, well, you know, we're going to violate all the laws. We're going to strong arm our way into forcing sovereign powers to comply to our wishes against the president of another sovereign power. Why? Because there's somebody that we don't like on the plane. Now, I mean, there are lots of people in this world that I don't like, but I don't think that states should have the power or the right to oblige others to be subjected to this kind of thing. The trouble with all of these things is you can always justify it on the event, but if you look at the principle behind it, it is an extremely alarming principle. When is it the next time there's going to be some prime minister of some other country they don't like and they force him onto the ground and arrest him? And if we can perhaps, let's play this in reverse. Let's suppose Mr. Kissinger was overflying The Hague at some point. And then all of a sudden someone said, well, there's a war criminal suspect overflying our country, ground the airplane, refuse access to any other airspace. How would the Americans react then? I mean, I think there's
guns, probably.
Well, with guns, yes. Who knows? But the point is, you cannot. International law is very flawed, but it's better than anything else we've got. And the more that you completely use and abuse those laws, the more you create a lawless state, the more you create dictators, and the more you give them strength to their bow. And I did think that Snowden, in this context, said one extremely wise thing. He said, the real threat is not me, because they can lock me up. And Julian Assange is in the same position. He's holed up in a ridiculous situation as well. But the real threat is that 300 million people may actually wake up and understand what's going on and start saying our government is doing things completely contrary to what we would want in our country. How is this happening and how can we stop it? So there are two approaches. One is the one if I were trying to manipulate, I would have done, which is very low key. Or the other is this, which is the John Wayne approach to international relations, where everybody sees in stark reality exactly what the name of the game is. I think those are
exactly
my
right. And it's a, I mean, what I find so remarkable about this is the type of precedent that this seems to set in terms of the consequences for people who are seeking refugee status. Presumably, if Snowden had been on the plane, it would have been because the Bolivian president either had granted him asylum and refugee status in Bolivia, or because they were taking him to Bolivia at least to hear his case. Either way, for other countries to stop the Bolivian president from doing that is a pretty remarkable thing. Again, I can't see how this won't be used as some sort of precedent for future.
I mean, at the end of the day, that little private jet could have become the new Ecuadorian embassy parked for the next 20 years in the middle of Vienna Airport. And we have seen this before, because in Eastern Europe there was a cardinal in, I think it was Czechoslovakia some many years ago, who ended up living in the American embassy for almost 30 years. Now, have we, the West, got so advanced in the way that we do things that we're behaving in a way which is exactly like the Soviet dictatorship did in the Eastern Bloc all that time ago? And if that's the case, then what's this all been about in the first place? It really is, it is frightening and tragic.
Well, certainly one part of what's going on is the war on whistleblowers. And again, whatever Snowden is and whatever he's been doing, I think one thing that his case has highlighted is the fact that, yes, there is a concerted war on whistleblowers that is going on in the Obama administration and has been for quite some time. And from one type of manhunt to another, not only is there a war on whistleblowers, of course, there's the attendant war on journalists who bother to report on what the whistleblowers are saying. So, for example, David Gregory on Meet the Press floating the idea that perhaps Glenn Greenwald should be arrested for having reported on this story. A pretty remarkable thing for a country that still at least pretends to espouse affiliation to the First Amendment. But but just some remarkable things that are happening. And of course, in that war on journalism, we just saw what could have been a casualty in that war with Michael Hastings, the reporter for Rolling Stone and BuzzFeed, who famously penned the article in Rolling Stone in 2010 that led to the dismissal of General Stanley McChrystal from the head of the ISAF in Afghanistan. A pretty important reporter in a lot of different ways, and one who was getting increasingly vocal about his opposition to the establishment in general, and who was apparently working on a story about the CIA and was believed himself, at any rate, to be under investigation by the FBI, sending a panicked email just hours before his fiery death in a mysterious car crash that saw his engine being thrown 50 to 60 yards away from the car, which was already on fire before it even hit the tree. Just a bizarre story in lots of ways. Your take on what happened to Michael Hastings there in California last month?
Well, I find the whole thing extraordinary, and you're quite right. He has certainly been stamping on the establishment's feet, particularly the industrial military complex establishment. He's also had a go at David Petraeus, who, let's say, is portrayed as being a highly honorable gentleman, apart from the fact, you know, he cheated on his wife and made his first big career move by marrying the boss's daughter when he was at West Point. And then, of course, one hears the comments that are made about him by fellow senior ranking officers who think he's just a political slime ball. So, I mean, these are the things that are being said. We can turn the clock back to Mr. Breitbart, who mysteriously disappeared with a heart attack on the street approximately at the same time as he also was about to announce a release on some very big and important story. And you kind of put these things together and say, how does it work? Now, there's an extremely good journalist who you may or may not know of in Germany called Lars Schall, who follows two things with great intensity, this kind of event and also the gold rigging and where the Germans' physical gold is. And he is, amongst other things, wrote to Mercedes-Benz saying, how is it that one of your upper-class cars could suddenly disintegrate in this most improbable way and burst into fire and flames when basically the car is designed not to burst into fire and flames in any circumstances? And how can a motor, which is meant to be attached firmly to a chassis, be found 50 meters away from the car? I mean, this is something that I'm not a physicist or a mathematician, but I know the force and energy to to do that kind of thing is extremely more than you're going to get from a simple impact of bouncing into a tree or a burst petrol tank. So the whole thing merits extremely close investigation. And of course, what we're being fed with at the same time is how this dreadful person is stuck in an airport in potentially in Vienna, and that covers all the news. So we get all the things that are not relevant, and the thing where one should be seriously asking a question of what is the LA Police Department doing about this? What is the state, you know, what are the CIA and other investigators doing about this? What is the press doing about it? And there is almost no coverage. It's just a great big smokescreen. And it takes me back to O.J. Simpson, where, you know, I've seen his car on a video, you know, his SUV on a video driving, being followed by police cars. I guess that's been on television billions of times. And I just wonder what goes on in the minds of the average member of the American population when he sees things like this. I mean, are they completely devoid of reasoning capacity? In which case, perhaps they deserve the outcome they're going to have, which is they're going to be enslaved by a system that just slowly puts them to sleep and unfortunately allows the most powerful nation in the world to go unchecked and uncontrolled in pursuing policies to the great detriment of the other 80% of the world who are not actually American. It's not at all a happy picture.
It isn't. And you bring up so many good points. Breitbart, of course, the connection there with a 41-year-old who drops dead of a heart attack on the street on the very morning of the day that he said he was going to be releasing a video damaging to Barack Obama's re-election campaign. And that death ruled of natural causes by a coroner who himself ends up dying a few weeks later of arsenic poisoning. Just some bizarre things going on that, again, are not even touched on in the mainstream media. And one has to scratch their head. And then, of course, the Breitbart.com, which is his namesake and lives on, is now denigrating anyone who's asking questions about Michael Hastings' death. So this all feeds into itself and unfortunately becomes something of a closed loop of controlled outlets. And it will be interesting to see if Rolling Stone or BuzzFeed or any of these outlets does some follow-ups. The Young Turks, which Michael Hastings was also associated with, has been doing some good investigative work as to what has actually happened. So we'll have to continue following that story. But one other aspect of that story that I find head-scratching in a number of ways is that just a week or so after his death, Huffington Post actually contacted Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism czar for Clinton and Bush, who gave Huffington Post a response saying that basically he believes that what happened with Michael Hastings' car is consistent with a car cyber attack in which the systems are remotely controlled and thus cutting off the brakes or starting the acceleration up or anything that's controlled by the car's computer systems can be remotely hacked into, which he admits can be done by pretty much all of the major intelligence powers on the planet, including, of course, the United States. Which is a bizarre story. I can't understand for the life of me why Richard Clark would come out and say this, but there he is. And so giving credence to the people who believe there may have been something untoward with Michael Hastings' death. Your take on Richard Clark coming out in the midst of this, adding fuel to the fire?
I didn't actually know that, but I mean, it's a pretty impressive statement. You know, remote controlling a car must be something extremely easy to do. I mean, kiddies' toys do it. So to be able to electronically guide a car to places or into a wall could not be that difficult to anyone who wanted to be organized. I mean, for me, we talk about these things and the natural reply is, oh, conspiracy theory. But I'm not at all a conspiracy theorist. All I'm saying is I'd like to see the facts be investigated in a credible way, to the point which any logical reasoning citizen can say, well, that has to have been what happened. That's how the plane crashed. And, you know, they do that, not the plane, the car crashed. Now, for example, with planes, a plane comes down, you've got the NTSB that comes in, investigates, works out which parts blew up in extremely difficult circumstances, and they go right to the end of the investigation. But why is it that Mercedes doesn't want to do this? I think the answer is extremely clear, because they don't want to put their foot in a plate which makes the American sales market more difficult for them to access than it already is. So nobody wants to touch the problem. And in the meantime, you know, basically what we're seeing in America is journalists sending up much the same way as they would in Russia if they're speaking out against Mr. Putin.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And of course, that would be endlessly hounded on by the American media if it happened in Russia. But somehow, for some reason, it's not so it's such a big deal when it happens in the United States. Well, of course, the NTSB does a very thorough job, except for things like TWA-800, which is back in the news, interestingly enough. But moving along to some other matters, for people who have been following things, they may or may not know that Bank of England's new governor, Mark Carney, the Canadian, who's been parachuted in to take over the Lady of Threadneedle Street, has presided over his first monetary committee meeting of the Bank of England, and I'd be interested to hear your take on Carney's reign as new BOE governor.
Well, I think it's a little bit early to say, but he's affectionately called Mr. Carnage or Mr. Carnivore, depending on which version you prefer. I think he's a smart guy. There's no doubt about that. He's a very charming guy. However, what it does is it kind of completes the triumvirate of control over the central banks by former Goldman Sachs guys. We've got Dudley at the Fed in New York. We've got Mr. Draghi with his paws all over Europe. And now we've got Carney at the UK. So, I mean, these three Goldman alumni will undoubtedly work very well together in pursuing the agenda of themselves and of presumably Goldman without too much concern for the underlying states involved. And I think what's happened so far is he's just making the first rumblings of I'm here, and yes, there might be a deflation risk, which means we need to print more money, but at the same time nobody in the committee wants to print money, etc., etc. So it's a case of the dog trying to bite its tail for the moment, and there will be an endless supply of contradictory statements coming out over the next while about how well the economy is going to juice up the stock market, and how badly things are going to justify not printing money for a little bit longer. And it'll just be the same farce that's gone on for years in all the other banking centers. So what hopes do I have for the future? I think he will end up doing the only thing that central bankers can, and that's print money. And there's an old saying about gold mines, that the definition of a gold mine is a hole in the ground with a liar standing at the top. And I think the definition of a central bank is a hole in the ground with a printing press at the bottom and three big liars standing at the top. I mean, they could never, ever tell the truth about what's going on in the economy, because if they did, it would crash. So what they have to do is do everything by subterfuge, and I'm staggered that the fact that the people in the financial press are capable of printing this stuff every day without ending up in taking severe doses of Prozac every night to keep themselves sane.
Exactly right. And just to back up what you're saying, Bloomberg's latest headline shows that the pound has slumped to its a four-month low as Carney is giving dovish signals there at the BOE. So I think you're exactly right. We're likely to see more stimulus and more debasement of the currency as the global currency wars continue, despite the G8's assurances that nothing of the sort is happening. Again, this leads to the question of what's in store, not only in England, but around the world. And of course, all eyes continue to be on the Fed, which has perhaps given signals that the tapering is about to commence with their own quantitative easing programs. But in the wake of that statement by Ben Bernanke at the public, the press conference after the FOMC meeting, the market slumped, and basically every single major Fed official came out in the wake of that trying to calm fears and saying, oh, well, that they were reading too much into this, blah, 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 we're not tapering yet. So I think all eyes will be on September and what happens then, what kind of decision is made then, and the 100th anniversary of the Fed, actually, I believe. So should be an interesting time coming up this fall. Until then, we've seen a lot of volatility in a lot of markets, including, of course, the gold market. And since we've been covering that repeatedly here on the program, I think we should probably cover the latest in gold, which is a huge drop in prices that's happened over the past few months. And we have definitely seen the end of the incredible bull run that we saw over the past 13 years or so in the gold markets, and we're into bearish territory. Your take on what's happening right now with gold prices?
Well, I'm a substantial gold investor on a small scale, but substantial for me. So I'm not very happy about what's happening. But none of the fundamentals which should lead gold to go up in price have changed. So I'm not a seller. And I do understand that there's a complete dichotomy between the paper gold business, which can be made anything that the powers that be want to, and the physical. And you're basically seeing that the further the price down goes down, the more the uplift of physical gold, particularly in China and India. So the actual available gold in the world is leaving vaults at a tremendous pace. And from my point of view, you may find this a bit ridiculous, but if you take gold today at around 1,200, I think the real price of paper gold should be around $12. Because there's 100 times more paper than there is gold. So the day that you actually ask for delivery, you're going to get a piece of paper which is worth whatever it's worth, and $12 worth of gold. So I think the efforts they made to suppress the gold price so far have been immensely unsuccessful, if you take that particular logic. And ultimately, there's going to be a disconnect. And I do follow quite closely the physical inventories that are available in the COMEX, which is the main futures trading market, and in GLD, which is the main gold ETF, and the physical, it's ratcheting down at a tremendous rate. So will there be a physical default? If I were looking at the likelihood of there being a physical default and trying to limit the damage, what I would definitely do before that is drive the price as hard down as I could as possible, because then the actual payout in paper money is going to be that much less. And the other thing that's fascinating is to watch that the people who are long and short on gold, the people who are short at the moment are very substantially the hedge funds and the like. And those who have moved their positions from being completely short to almost long are the big banks. So as the big banks are the gold traders, and they have the inside knowledge, I would not like to be on the short side of that particular trade when someone says, we've driven the price down far enough, now let's take it up the other way. Because then the people who are sitting with their shorts that they've taken on recently are going to be in horrendous trouble. And that is such an easy game for the big banks. They've got unlimited amounts of money to pump into taking positions, and if those positions go wrong on them, they just go to the Fed and ask for more money, or the American government say, we're basically doing this to manipulate gold for you, so we take the upside and let the American people or whatever other people around the world take the downside. So gold is, for me, it's far from a game that's all over. I think it's, if anything, it's a game which is moving into a terminal phase where some people are going to get extremely, extremely badly burned by making the wrong decisions. And the only thing I'm sure is not the wrong decision is to have physical gold.
Well, if their intention is to drive a lot of people out of the gold market in order that they can go switch from their short to long, I think that they've accomplished that to a large degree.
Yeah. Well, one thing you should never underestimate, you see so many people say Mr. Bernanke's a fool. These people are anything but fools. They are extremely smart, and they can manipulate markets. They know how to take positions. They know how to get in, how to get out. They know how to bluff and cover their tracks most of the time. I think they're doing a masterful job. I mean, the only unfortunate thing is that none of the things that they do are actually for the benefit of the economy or the citizenry whose money they're using to do these things. That's the problem. But dumb they are certainly not.
I agree with you. I think that there's a lot more manipulation and control behind these seemingly random moves than a lot of people give credit for. We've covered a lot of bases this month. Anything else that you'd like people to cogitate on before we leave?
No, I think we've done a pretty comprehensive tour. Thanks once again for being on your show. I always enjoy it. It's a great way to start of the month and a great way to get my brain in gear thinking about things of importance.
Good. Well, no problem on that front, but for there's always new people tuning into these conversations. So for anyone who is tuning in for the first time, tell them a little bit about your website.
My website is, as you said at the beginning, is rather long, thegenevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com. You will see on that links to my business website. I basically give financial advice, not investment advice generally, but financial advice. And if, from what you've heard today, there's anything that interests you, don't hesitate to go to my Blogspot and contact me directly. And if I can help, I will most certainly try to do so. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for your time. Looking forward to talking to you again next month.
Good. Likewise. Thanks a lot.